Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, you know that, and I have been asked to bring this topic up for good reason. I don't know if there's anything that anyone on this side of the world can do in terms of influence, but you'll let us know if, in fact, there is. You're aware of the fact that the Israeli government has decided on more than one occasion, including recently, to take down synagogues that have been built, most recently in the small community of Givat Aryeh, adjacent to Itamar. There was a group there dedicating a Sefer Torah back on November the 15th in an Aron Kodesh of the new synagogue that was done and built in memory of the Fogel family members who were murdered by Arab terrorists. Malcolm, is there anything that we on this side of the world can do to stop Israeli action when they feel it's necessary to take down shuls and homes that have been built recently? And do you think that the Prime Minister actually would ever make this issue a priority?
Would make which issue the priority? Taking them down or building them up?
No, but leaving them and answering the call that it's inappropriate to take them down.
Well, obviously, he has to be part of the decision, though it's not his, essentially. It's the Ministry of Defense that makes decisions when it comes to these things, and they're under, you know, tremendous international pressure about the, outposts and new and the expansion, et cetera. And the commitment that he's made was always that the new construction was within the existing footprints and existing communities of Yehuda and Shomron. So I can't tell you that anything will never be or ever be, but that seems to be the policy now.
And nothing that we on this side, other than exhibiting through protests, through communication.
I always think responsible expressions of concerns when people have them and disagreements can be communicated, can be expressed to the government and through legitimate vehicles.
We know symbolically how it looks when a synagogue is taken down by the Israeli government. Do you think that it's in fact different than homes or other structures?
I personally obviously feel that it's different, but the question was whether people, what's done legally, what's not done legally, what people have a permit for, and why the target. There's no homes, I think, in nearby there. I think the synagogue was the only structure.
Yeah, I was saying in general that when this happens, it seems that...
Of course, I'm sure it's much more painful for them to have to do it.
It seems that there's more rocket fire. Jerusalem Post has a headline: Gaza rocket fire continues. Three more Qassams fired at Israel. Palestinians say civilian killed, 13 wounded in IDF response. The 10 rockets fired into southern Israel from Gaza. What's the latest from that side of the border?
Well, this started because Israel found two guys who were in a car who were about to carry out a terrorist attack, a launching of missiles. They eliminated them. At least one was killed, the other probably hurt, and if any civilians were injured, there was no evidence of it initially, but these were terrorists who, and Israel has limited itself now to going right after those responsible and has successfully eliminated a few in recent weeks, caught them as they were launching or as they were about to launch missiles, and that's because of good intelligence and drones and other things that are able to monitor what's happening across the border. And it doesn't mean that this is necessarily Hamas or an organized thing. It can be, you know, one of the smaller groups, and Israel has the information, knows who they are, and took them out. This was a retaliation then, supposedly, for that, where the initial Grad missile, which is what's more significant, fired at Er Sheva, and then a number of Qassam rockets were fired subsequently. Thank God, at least in the initial volleys, there was no real damage done. I haven't seen the tally yet. They haven't released the tally on whether anything else happened during the night, any direct hits. But it's just a reminder that while things are quiet on the border or appear to be quiet, we have to remember what is sitting there, the thousands, maybe even tens of thousands of rockets in Gaza, much of coming from Libya since the fall of Gaddafi, in addition to what faces Israel on the north. And it doesn't take much to escalate, and right now we see Hamas under incredible pressure, and sometimes this is to relieve pressure, or they allow people to do things, some of the other terrorist groups, in order to relieve the pressure on them. Because right now, Iran has cut back on the funding, there's a threat to cut it all off. If they go ahead with the plan to pull out of Syria, which is already happening, hundreds of Hamas officials and operatives left Syria for Gaza as part of the, you know, in fear for the fall of Assad's regime. First of all, it shows us how big the infrastructure was there. Second, it shows a split now because Turkey has offered them $300 million in support if they do leave from Syria. So they're caught in a vise now because they have a lot of pressure from Iran and, of course, from Syria because they were critical of the murder of the Sunnis and the Palestinians in Syria. The Syrians didn't tolerate it. The Hezbollah took the other course, and that Nasrallah came out now in support of Syria, which is still supplying them weapons. And we know just recently very sophisticated weapons coming from Russia, and the fear is that that will end up in the hands of Hezbollah as
well. So now there's a greater Hezbollah-Hamas split because of Nasrallah's public statements in support of Assad?
That's a very good question. The two don't necessarily coordinate. The coordinated party is Iran between them. But if they have an order to attack simultaneously, there is communication obviously between them. But Iran is the critical juncture on those kind of an order, that kind of an order. But each one in and of itself is split. The Hamas has big differences within about which direction to go. They're claiming that they have a big shortfall of money because of the cutback by Iran of the funding of the Hamas guys, and then Turkey coming in and offering this money as a replacement. But the real split is with Hezbollah because they're dependent upon Syria for the shipment of arms right now.
Right, that's why he had to come out publicly and support him.
That's why he did it.
Right, for those who are wondering why he just didn't stay quiet on the whole matter. It seems that Israel's patience threshold back to Gaza for a moment is different than it was years ago. Is it accurate to paint the picture that they're simply more impatient when it comes to these rocket attacks than they were willing to be in terms of patience years ago?
Well, I would have to describe it as going two ways. One is you're correct about Israel responding. The policy is to go immediately after those who fire. When they fire, if they can identify the source or prevent the firing by having advanced intelligence that something like this is going to take place. But they also are being very careful because they don't want to escalate the tensions with Egypt right now because of what the Egyptian government is going through. I think Israel has demonstrated, you know, a lot of sensitivity in terms of their actions along the border. There are people, including high-ranking army and former army leaders, who are saying Israel will have to go back into Gaza and clean out these nests and to try to do away with some of the stockpiling. But the government of Israel, it seems, has taken a more targeted approach, which is effective, but also minimizes the criticism of the international community if they should be concerned about it, and that is to go after specific cases, specific targets, and eliminating them.
Is Assad the beneficiary of the ethnic tension in Syria? I mean, you've described it to us many times in terms of the split, both geographically and ethnically, you'd call it, right? Is he benefiting from it? If there was a more united front in Syria, he'd probably be out by now?
That's a very good question and a good assessment of, as I said, Syria was not a real country. It was cobbled together by the colonialists. It has Alawites, Assad being one, who are about 10% of the population. They think, and he thinks, they will be annihilated. And I've talked about the arms buying, et cetera. The Christians have come out again this past week in support of Assad because they fear his fall will subjugate them to the terror of the Sunnis and the Shiites and to other groups within. You have Druze, you have Bedouin, you have others who live there, Huranis. So there's no unifying identity, and we've seen the escalation of the tensions within. Even in Damascus now, we're hearing, both because there's electricity being cut, food prices are up, but that young people there have participated in demonstrations. They don't get generally reported. And And this is being compounded now by Syria's relationship with Turkey, where Turkey now has taken a very aggressive stand, even though they were a key ally. And Assad, it is reported, has now allowed the PKK, which is the Kurdish Workers Party, it's a terrorist group that has been attacking Turkey all along too, and was banned from Syria in 1998 when they made a peace treaty with Turkey, has allowed them to come back, which is a direct affront against Turkey. But Turkey has been allowing defectors to organize along the Turkish-Syrian border, giving them protection. There are big refugee camps that have grown along the Turkish border, but on the Turkish side, many of the attacks have been launched from this area. Turkey says it's from the other side of the border. The Syrians are saying it's from within. And this also ends up being a Turkish-Iranian conflict, with each side threatening the other, and they are now in complete competition globally. So you have so many factors that affect the tensions, but what you're saying is the core, because the Fourth Army is dependent upon support of the Alawites, Christians, and others, and Sunnis who support that one army, which is carrying out all of these military actions. You eliminate that, you've taken away his ability to respond.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. By the way, Assad has an issue with people like you, Mr. Honlein, because you've been telling us that there's been a crackdown in Syria over the last few months that has resulted in the murder of thousands at this point. Assad was on network television in a network interview in the United States, which got a lot of attention. He flatly denied it, said it's absolutely false.
Well, you see, that's why you can't believe the media, and you can't believe your lying eyes when you see all the thousands of bodies, 60 of them in one day, in Hamas, just dumped in the middle of the center city of the city center by militia groups, and the documentation. And I think that the groups have learned the lesson from the Palestinians. You don't exaggerate. You do things based upon facts, because ultimately the lie will be put to you. Assad seems to be living in denial. And I don't mean the river. I mean he just does not want to face the reality of what's happening. And he believes still that this is all a Mossad, U.S., CIA, Turkish, other plot against him, and that it's not the expression of the people. And despite the fact that, you know, the economy is in ruins, he still has support. As he said, his economic lungs are Lebanon and Iran. His political shield is Russia. The demonstrations now against Hezbollah, against Russia, are growing. The signs against them at the demonstrations. Russia has made a commitment here because they see this as their sphere of influence, Syria. They have invested a lot of money in a naval presence in Tartus. They've said now that in January they're going to put an aircraft carrier and all sorts of ships there. They continue to sell them weapons now, including this advanced cruise missile-type missile, their version of it, which the fear is not that he will use it because it's against ships. It goes about 300 kilometers into the sea, but because it can be used by Hezbollah and that it will end up in Hezbollah. The United States is doing a lot now to try and keep track of the huge chemical weapons that are stored in storage in Syria that they have accumulated over the years. So balance there, the ability of him to continue is diminishing all the time. But as long as he doesn't face the reality, as long as he's driven by the fact that he knows what the result will be, it'll be, you know, massacres. And I think the West ought to make an announcement that they will protect the Alawites, that they will protect the Christians and others, but mean it. Go to NATO, go to the Arab League, get other groups together, let them say it. You will see that those groups will diminish their support. Right now, their fear is he falls, they go.
Do his neighbors fear him like in the past? I'm talking about those outside of Syria. What does Jordan think of Syria? What does Saudi Arabia think of Syria?
Well, Saudi Arabia hates Syria, has always hated Syria, and is supplying money and funds to some of the dissident groups, we believe. Jordan lives in fear because he has threatened to send people across the border. Some of the defectors have gone to are right on the Jordanian border. Some may even hiding in Jordan, but the fear on the part of Jordan is that he will carry out his threats to undermine the government, to work with the extremist groups within Jordan, and he has his own problem with the Muslim Brotherhood, that they will seek to exploit it. I think that that's more of a hollow threat. I think he's got more than enough to worry about you know, in his own backyard, that he doesn't have to do it. But
I saw
from Saudi Arabia, just on a side that people hope notice, is the announcement that they're going to spend $80 billion building 16 civilian nuclear reactors in the next 2 years, and talking even about getting nuclear weapons because they see the failure to stop Iran. And when you talk about who they hate Syria, and they hate Iran even more.
Their economy is still powerful, Saudi Arabia, or not?
Absolutely.
So they have they have
oil flows, they have money.
So with this announcement, they have the potential. On paper, they have the potential to become a real superpower.
This is nuclear power. This is nuclear reactors for supposedly civilian use.
Right.
So that everything is fungible, and ultimately the technology can be transferred. But they don't hide the aspiration. But they don't need to build a nuclear weapon. They bought it. They paid for the program in Pakistan. And they may already have some nuclear bombs and nuclear capacity, because Saudi princes were always seen there. I reported here 15 years ago about the Saudi princes being at these nuclear programs and nuclear production sites in Pakistan, and that's because they footed the bill on a lot of this.
So are they a Middle East superpower or not at this point?
I would not say that they're a Middle East superpower. They're an economic superpower, because they also have the leverage that they can turn and turn off the spigot. Part of the way the Europeans are being told they can compensate for the loss of Iranian oil is that Saudi Arabia has a spare capacity of probably 2 million barrels a day that could compensate for the loss that they would suffer. When you have the oil, you have the power.
True or false, Iran shot down a U.S. drone this week.
They shot down a stealth drone, which is a special kind, but very highly sophisticated, which also goes over the area. It wasn't just along the border, though this one they claim was lost, flying along the Iranian border, and may not have been shot down, but fell down. They're made to collapse, because there's very highly sensitive technology on these drones that enable them to monitor, and if they, as they have, captured one. Now, how much damage was done to it is not clear from the picture, because if it fell from a high, they fly very high level, and if they were at that altitude and fell, it would have been destroyed. It's clear from the picture that it isn't. Whether it's in fact a fake or not, we have to see. But they did capture it. They have it. It's a matter of concern to intelligence and to those who use these units, because you can learn a lot from it. But these are very effective, and America has a whole fleet of these, about 20 of them, operating in Pakistan and Afghanistan and near the Iranian border. But they also have the capacity to carry out attacks. You can shoot a missile from one of these.
Mm-hmm. All right, little teaser. Those of you who are anxiously awaiting my question to Malcolm regarding the ads that the Prime Minister pulled this week, it is coming up. Be patient. We're trying to hold the audience for a moment. Malcolm, I don't know if you saw him last night at the White House or not, Defense Secretary Panetta at the Saban Forum, an annual weekend seminar hosted by the Saban Center for Middle East Policy. When asked about measures that should be taken by Israel to advance the peace process, Panetta, true to his reputation as a straight shooter, responded, quote, "Just get back to the damn table." The Pentagon chief also pointed out the trend of Israel's growing isolation. And while explaining that there were several reasons for this problem, Panetta seemed to lay part of the blame on Israel when he stated, and I quote, "I have never known an Israeli government, or an Israeli for that matter, to be passive about anything, let alone this troubling trend." Your reaction?
Well, his speech was very troubling, and not because of the line, which was an answer to a question at the end of his appearance at this forum in Washington, where he said, when he was asked, what is it that Israel could do? And he said, get to the damn table, get to the table. First of all, there is no table, and if there is one, it has no legs, because there's nobody else sitting at that table. And there's no basis to press Israel for negotiations. Israel has every day, including this week, said, we'll meet anytime, anywhere, but just tell me who's going to be at the other side of the table. Who are they going to speak to? But there were other parts in the written text which were very disturbing, and people should know that Panetta, a longtime member of Congress, was a great supporter of Israel and a friend of Israel, considers himself a great friend of Israel now, spoke very positively about many aspects of the U.S.-Israel cooperation and military relationship. There were very disturbing parts. One, for instance, where he says that Israel should reach out to Turkey and try to ameliorate the Turkey Israel has done everything possible. Turkey keeps raising the price. This guy Erdogan, who is Islamist and becoming much more extreme, and plays off of the animosity towards Israel as a way of increasing his popularity. How does Jordan exist today if it weren't for the support of Israel? And look at the restraint that Israel has shown to Egypt along the border in trying to prop up and work with the generals and to help stability in Egypt. So these, and I have to say that I take great affront because we see this constant message coming from different officials about Israel's isolation. Israel has more diplomatic legions, more government-to-government meetings, more business interchanges. In many areas, Israel's much less isolated. It's true that what's happened in Egypt, what's happened in Turkey, makes the situation in the region more difficult. But it's not just for Israel, it's for everybody. Mm-hmm. The victory of the Muslim Brotherhoods across North Africa is not Israel's isolation alone. It is the isolation of Europe, which is right across the Mediterranean from these countries and has an integral relationship with them. It's for the United States. It's for everybody. Saudi Arabia, you could say, is more isolated today with the fall or changes in the governments in Egypt, what's happening in other parts. And I think it's a negative message, and I did communicate this yesterday to White House officials, and I think that they accepted it and heard it. And, you know, I'm not saying that they said it in order to hurt Israel, but I think that it is harmful when those references are made.
Panetta urged Israel to increase its efforts to reconcile with Turkey. You just mentioned that. He openly rebuked Israeli arguments about the effectiveness of a possible military attack against Iran's nuclear facilities. And that's an American public statement about what Israel should or shouldn't do regarding Iran.
Well, that is subject to interpretation, I think, a little bit about what to what degree and whether that was an intentional rebuke of Israel or not. There is close cooperation and close exchanges and ongoing joint exercise and many other things.
As you keep reminding us.
Between the military. And because Israel is appreciated more, not mm-hmm. less, because mm-hmm. of what Israel brings to the equation as well, in addition to the support for the security of Israel. And the problem was that it came in the midst of a weekend where we heard Hillary Clinton, you know, compare Israel in a sense to Iran and attacking them about women sitting in the back of the bus because somebody obviously whispered something in her ear. And
Clinton lashed out at attempts by Israeli lawmakers with some backing from the Netanyahu government to limit the activity of civil society non-governmental organizations. She also said to have expressed anger at accounts of increased gender segregation in Israel. She took particular issue with reports that women are required to take the back seats on a certain bus line, a demand that reminded her of Rosa Parks and the American civil rights struggle.
But the comparison to Iran, the comparison to Rosa Parks, is just—it's ludicrous, and I don't know why. Who told her this, and why is she so little informed? And that's the subject that when you're talking about Israel, that you have to discuss. And it came also on a weekend when you had the American ambassador to Belgium,
right,
had a forum the day before.
Gutman.
Gutman, who is Jewish, by the way, making this ridiculous statement about anti-Semitism. For which he sort of backed off.
He explained that one aspect of Jew hatred was, quote, largely born of and reflecting the tension between Israel, the Palestinian territories, and neighboring Arab states in the Middle East over the continuing Israeli-Palestinian problem.
So the confluence of all those three things in a short period gave the impression of an assault that was taking place. And the reaction in Israel, the reaction here, of course, was very strong. And obviously that was a major subject of discussion all day yesterday, but all week long, literally around the clock on Saturday night and Sunday, about, you know, these things were outrageous, and it really undermines the relationship and puts Israelis in a frame of mind where they look at this and they say, you know, this can't be just a coincidence that you have these three things, even though they were completely unrelated. And it wasn't a speech. The Panetta speech wasn't vetted by the White House. It wasn't something, you know, that they gave him orders to go out there and do this. He just did it. And I think because he considers himself a great friend, he gave himself a lot more license than he should have.
Did you see Panetta yesterday?
I did not see Panetta.
And now to my favorite story of the week. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is canceling an ad. This happened, by the way, like an hour after we got off the air last Friday. Netanyahu is canceling an ad campaign aimed at luring Israeli expatriates home that some American Jews have found offensive. The ads, produced by Israel's Ministry of Immigrant Absorption, attempt to convey the message that the children and families of Israeli expats will not have Israeli identities if they stay in the diaspora. This week, the Jewish Federations of North America called the ads insulting, and the head of the ADL said they were demeaning. Number one, Malcolm, do you agree that they're insulting and demeaning or not?
Not to reach out to Israelis and to try to get them to come home, I think, is perfectly appropriate. I think the choice of some of the language was not smart, and it was not done by the prime minister. It was done by one ministry, the Ministry of Absorption, took this initiative. I think doing it is one thing. The way they do the text of it, the context, which they did not think was insulting, I think was even meant probably some guy who thought that it was humorous or catchy. That was the problem. It was not the fact that they want to bring Israelis home. That's been a program that's been going on for a long time.
A program meaning like an ad campaign that's been going on for a long time?
Efforts, shlichim coming here, people working with the...
Well, shlichim, the impression's always been that
other people, but even, you know, publication stuff that they've done. But the problem here was the text of it. I don't think it should have been elevated to the degree of a public conversation. I think it should have been done quietly and got him to remove it. I think it was a mistake for the prime minister to remove it. It should have been done by a third-level person who just because he wasn't responsible for it. He didn't see it beforehand. He didn't even know about it. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs didn't know about it. So whoever knew about it should have done it, because once you put the prime minister in it, you make it a New York Times story. You escalate its significance. And I'm sure he wanted to just show that he was being responsive, but this should not have been handled at that level.
See, I wonder what would have happened if the ad campaign was not aimed at Israelis in the United States or North America, but if the ad campaign was aimed at Jews in general and would have said you're going to lose your Jewish identity unless you come back or come to the State of Israel.
Well, there are people who come here and who do say those things, and there are people here who believe that, and... Now that you're right, it would have been interesting to see.
I would have liked to have seen. What would the ADL have said if that would have been the subject of the campaign? Not aimed at Israelis, but a general global Jewish initiative to get people to understand that the future of the Jewish people is in the State of Israel.
Again, I don't think the objection would be to the fact that they do the campaign. Depends on how you present it. You know, for the public to see something about that appears, or they claim appeared to diminish or Christmas, created a lot of sensitivities and negative backlash, even though it really wasn't demeaning and wasn't intended to be demeaning, but as you said, to assert that message. So I think you got to be sensitive when you do things about not just what you intend, but how do people perceive it, how is it heard, you know, what the reaction to it is.
So I can't get you to admit that the ad campaign was a great idea, huh?
Well, I'm not upon more favor of getting Israelis to go
I
back
know.
And to use creative ways to do it, and it's something, you know, I speak to them, and again, I just think that that's the point here. I would not go public, and I don't think that all the public statements are necessary. I think you should have done it quietly and gotten rid of it, and that would have been sufficient.
After all, when you speak anywhere in the United States, all you ever say to people is you got to move to Israel. That's at least what I hear about your public appearances.
Well, both directly and indirectly, I tell them that. By the way, did you see the Holy Land Foundation case? That this is a very important story and got no coverage, but the Holy Land Foundation, which was caught, you know, several years ago for and five leaders in prison, that the court reviewed the case on appeal and came down and reaffirmed the conviction. This was an Islamist fund that raised money for terrorist organizations, and they said that there was voluminous evidence to uphold a decision against them. And I think this is really an important story, because people always question whether, you know, the charges against them, and they claim that the Holy Land Foundation was, you know, really a legitimate charitable operation. Again, showing us that the message is at home. And the other thing I hope people saw was that Sarkozy explained why he was so angry, why he made the comments about Bibi.
I didn't see that explanation.
Exchange with Obama.
What is it, Lou?
He said it's because they didn't allow France to get enough credit on the release of Shalit, that he wanted to send a French helicopter to Egypt and Israel didn't allow it.
Interesting.
And the French ambassador not playing more of a role. I mean, this is unbelievable, but he said this publicly, and they said it more than once now, that explaining his anger was because they didn't get enough credit when it came to the release of Shalit.
By the way, Arut Sheva is reporting that Israel detained a prisoner exchange for Shalit last night. I don't know why.
A prisoner who was released in the deal.
Yeah, what did I say? Yeah, I mean, you know what I mean. Somebody who was traded for Gilad Shalit. Supposedly was detained by police last night. I don't know why. Some suspicion of something, but I found that interesting. We were waiting to see how long that would take. Not, again, not for a crime, but I think on suspicion of being found at a checkpoint, you know, some questionable circumstance. Anybody wants to look at it, it's on a Route 7.
People think that they're just released and nothing is done afterwards. It isn't true. They're monitored. They want to see where they go.
Ah, so maybe that's why he was detained, because they knew who he was.
Of course. They know who many of them are, certainly the key ones that, about whom they are concerned.
Yeah, I want to be careful how I say that. Finally, Malcolm, there was a report last week, which I didn't get to, that the failure of the super committee appointed by Congress to reach a deficit reduction deal on the federal budget could cost Israel $250 million a year. For the first time in decades, there could be a reduction in U.S. aid to Israel due to automatic across-the-board budget cuts scheduled to take effect January of 2013. Have you heard anything about this from Washington?
Yes, absolutely. This has been discussed, but many members of Congress have given assurances that this would not impact Israel, that they would protect the aid to Israel. This is the one reason why we have a foreign aid bill, I think, largely because of the aid to Israel.
Right.
So I'm not sure that would be endangered. And I will tell you, you saw the vote in the Senate of 100-0 about the Iranian Central Bank.
Right.
You see the sentiment in Congress on both sides of the aisle is very strong. And speaking to members of Congress yesterday, and I told them what's going on in Venezuela, where they've had a 70% increase in their trade with Iran. Venezuela signing 70 deals for $17 billion with Iran. Bolivia now, $1 billion in trade with Iran. I said, well, we saw the meeting that took place where they Chavez convened all the countries of South America with Cuba, but leaving out the United States and Canada in an organization comparable to the OAS, the Organization of American States. This is significant because it brings home the message about the danger here and reinforces what Israel faces immediately every day. Mm. And here we are seeing the encroaching influence and presence and ability, capacity that Iran is building and that Chavez said specifically was meant to undermine the Monroe Doctrine to end American influence in the Western Hemisphere and to see Iran's growing influence and all the warnings that Israel gave all along are being borne out. And I think that it's a mistake, I told, not to bring to the American people the message so they understand that we're not fighting Iran because of something 8,000 miles away, but because of something right here, an hour off our coast or 2 hours off our coast of the southern United States. And this message about the immediacy of the danger and many other things that take place consistently reaffirmed to members of Congress and to others, to the American people, I think, why the significance of the relationship with Israel and what Israel has been saying all along that people dismissed as hyperbole, the things that we've talked about here for 10 years warning people about these things that I know many of them dismissed and think that it's just scare tactics. It's not. Believe me, it's only a fraction of what really goes on that we get a chance even to
deal with. All right, Malcolm, thank you so much. Have a great Shabbos. We'll speak next week.
God willing.
Malcolm Holmline, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.